Ms. Bridget J. Garrett and Ms. Sandra Jackson have been on the petition. Ms. Jackson, hello.
Good morning to the court. If you please, the court, this case originally was a termination case under Chapter 15 of the Texas Family Code. The case was initiated by the state of Texas against the natural parent. The appeal is based upon the lower court striking of a petition and intervention by the foster parent. The state of Texas did proceed to trial, at which time a judgment was entered after trial to the court, terminating the parental rights of the natural mother, and naming the natural father as the permanent managing conservator of the child. The intervener appealed the striking of the intervention from that judgment, at which the Court of Civil Appeals, the 5th Supreme Judicial District of Dallas, Texas, reversed and has remanded the case for trial. The petitioner is before the court on 5 points of error, and we shall only discuss points 2 and 4 on which the court granted the writ of error. Point of error number 2 is that the Court of Civil Appeals erred in holding that the trial judge abused his discretion in striking the plea and intervention. Point of error number 4 is that the foster parents lacked sufficient interest to intervene in a Chapter 15 termination suit under Rule 60 between the state of Texas and the natural parent, either by way of Rule 60 or under Section 11.03 of the Texas Family Code. We shall show the court that the cause should not have been reversed by the Court of Civil Appeals, and that the judgment of the trial judge should in fact be affirmed. Based upon the filing of the plea and intervention in October of 1979, the petitioner filed a motion to strike the plea on October 26th of 1979. A hearing was held on the petition, the striking of the plea and intervention in January, on the 9th day of January 1980, at which time the court, after hearing arguments of counsel concerning all the pleadings and the memorandum of law that was submitted to the bench, found as a matter of law and as a matter of pleadings that the plea in intervention should be and was stricken. We submit to the court that the striking of the plea in intervention was a valid exercise of the trial court's discretion, that which is accorded to him as the trier of fact and the one who had all the information before the court on that particular day. The situation basically was that the child had been removed from the home of the natural parent as a result of the emergency power in the state of Texas under Chapter 17 and subsequently placed into the home of the foster parent. Some 11 months after the proceedings were initiated in November of 1978, in October of 1979, the foster parents attempted to intervene in the trial of the case on the merits. The motion to strike states that the allowance of the plea and intervention would cause considerable delay, confusion of the trial, prejudice the rights of the natural parents as opposed to those of the foster parents, when in fact they had no interest that was justiciable enough based upon the plea that they filed for an intervention that would assert an equitable interest. The Brewers, we submit, had no right to intervene because they had no direct interest in the subject matter of the suit. The equitable interest that they alleged at the time the petition and intervention was filed was a mere contingent interest in that they had planned on filing an adoption as soon as legally possible. We submit to the court that the interest at the particular time that the plea and intervention was filed was too remote for them to intervene at that point. The interest was contingent upon the state of Texas obtaining a judgment terminating the parental rights of both the natural parent and subsequent to that time, or after the judgment reached the final stage, then of course the intervenors should the state of Texas had proven its case, been allowed to petition the court as the sex prospective adoptive parent of this particular child. The court, at the time of the hearing on the intervention in January of 1980, had gone through a series of review hearings, and a series of motions and cross motions had been filed by all counsel as well as the state of Texas with respect to the best interest of the child. The petition on its face did not seek any relief separate from that which the state of Texas was seeking, and that was the termination of parental rights of both the natural parents. What happened basically was that when they filed their plea and intervention, they asked in the prayer for relief that the state of Texas be named the managing conservator of the child, which in fact the state was already asserting that independent of the interest of the intervenors. We submit to the court that the petition was defective on its face, as well as after the court had all of the information before on that particular day in January of 1980, that the interest that they were alleging, which was an equitable interest in a plan on wanting to adopt this particular child, subsequent to the final judgment of termination, was too remote to, or not a legal interest, in that any rights that they were asserting at that particular point would be adversely affected by a judgment of termination or not termination. The state did proceed to trial in case the trial was to the bench. It was a three-day trial, at which time the foster parents were allowed to participate in the case by way of being a witness on behalf of the state, so that they could put forth the information that they sought to put before the court as to the best interest of the child. And although our courts are very liberal in permitting third parties to intervene in pending litigation, we submit that the allowance of a plea and intervention in this particular cause would in no way assist the court in determining what was in the best interest of the child, nor would it assist the original litigants, but would in fact be disadvantageous to their particular rights. The Brewers' interest as to the plan on filing the adoption, and the Brewers incidentally are the foster parents, was, as we said, too remote. The intervener's petition does not show by positive or vehemence that their rights were involved in the cause which was being litigated. They did not show themselves to be entitled to relief that they were seeking, which was in fact the state of Texas being named the managing conservator of the child, nor did they seek on the a relief apart from that which the state was already asserting. And we submit to the court that the interest of the asserted interest of the petition and intervention as to the best interest was being protected by the state of Texas through its authorized agent, the Texas Department of Human Resources, the Dallas County Child Welfare Unit, as well as by the attorney at large that had been appointed by the court in order to represent the interest of the child, which is the subject of the suit. The pleadings of the intervener did not conform to the requirements of pleading on the part of the plaintiff or petitioner respectively, and in this case, they did not allege any cause of action apart from those being alleged by the state of Texas. Although due regard should be given to the advantage of this of proceeding by intervention to prevent a multiplicity of lawsuits, we should guard against the disadvantages because of the tendency to multiply the issues and impose greater burden upon the trial court. In applying the rules of law as to the test of intervention, we submit that the Brewers are not asserting an interest that would be justiciable at that particular point. Of course, we are not asserting that they would never be able to initiate a proceeding such as a termination and adoption, because what they did in fact do was subsequent to the motion to strike, on the striking of their plea, some 5 or 6 days later, they instituted an independent cause of action for termination and adoption, at which point they attempted to consolidate that with the primary state, with the state's case. The court, of course, did not allow the consolidation as he had already heard the evidence on the motion to strike. The record also indicates that the trial court, in the information that he had before him at that particular point, reasonably exercised his discretion in the striking of the plea and intervention.
Counsel, to understand at the time of this motion to intervene and denial by the judge, the Brewers were the ones who attempted to intervene.
Yes, sir.
They did not have any suit whatever on file.
Yes, sir, they did not.
And this was merely to intervene in termination only.
Yes, sir.
And there was no adoption pled at that time.
The only thing that the Brewers pled in their petition and intervention so far as the adoption phase is concerned was that they had an equitable interest, not remote or contingent, in that they planned to file an adoption as soon as legally possible. That was the adoption question. The other thing that was before the court in their petition was that they alleged no additional facts, of course, outside of the state of Texas, and that which the state was already very much aware of. In fact, they were the ones that had instituted the proceedings. So the allegations in the petition did not request that the Brewers themselves be named managing conservator. They only asked that the state of Texas be named managing conservator, which the state, in fact, was seeking to do as a result of the trial case on the merits. The contentions of the motion to strike also included a delay. And in this case, we feel that the Court of Appeals erred in saying that the standard delay, confusion, issues as to a Rule 60 intervention when a motion to strike is filed by one of the opposing parties was insufficient. Because in this case, what we were attempting to do is delay will be the care of the foster parents, that exactly what it was intended to be. And that was a temporary substitute placement for a child who had been removed on a basis of an emergency proceeding from the home of its natural parents. The intention of this particular point, at that particular stage, of course, some 11 months after the proceedings had already been instituted, after several different hearings, motions by all parties as to further orders as to the best interest of the child, increased visitation, psychological evaluations, those kinds of things were before the court on the day that the court struck the plea and intervention. And in fact, prior to the time of the hearing on the plea and intervention, on that very same day, the court had several other motions that it heard prior to the time that they actually heard the evidence as to the plea and intervention. There was a visitation hearing, there was a motion for continuance because the case had been set for trial on about the 18th day of December in 1979. The plea had been filed on October the 18th, and counsel for respondent below was forced at that particular point to ask for a continuance because of the fact that the court had not ruled on the motion to strike. Then, when the court went ahead and granted or set the motions for a hearing, prior to the time the court reached the decision on the striking of the intervention, it also had heard evidence as to the psychological and emotional well-being of the child by various professionals, through the social worker herself, through the psychologist that evaluated the child, had spoken with the other parents that was involved, by the various interests asserted by the state of Texas and those persons that they sought to bring before the court at that particular hearing. And in fact, what happened was that the trial judge allowed the interveners to actively participate in the case from October of 1979, when they originally filed their petition and intervention, up until and including the day that the court finally did strike their plea. We would submit that delay is relevant in this kind of a cause because what in fact is involved here is a child who had been placed in a state of limbo because of the emergency situation that was surrounding his natural parents. The court subsequent to that time or prior to that time was very much aware of what was going on, and this particular trial judge is very active in allowing review hearings on a consistent basis within 30 days on motions of any party. He will allow a review hearing. He will hear all the evidence that's before him. And at that point, we are submitting to the court that the exercise of his discretion in filing, or rather in striking the plea and intervention, was reasonable and was not an arbitrary way. And what we also submit to the court is that the Court of Civil Appeals holding was that the trial court judge consequently abused his discretion. First of all, in finding that the issue that was before the Court of Civil Appeals was whether or not he did abuse his discretion. The court found first that the motion to strike was insufficient, that the Brewers had standing, and consequently the trial judge abused discretion. We submit to the court that there is no indication that the trial judge acted in an arbitrary and unreasonable way. The other information that was before the court, of course, was the confusion that would be allowed if the intervening foster parents were allowed to participate in the trial as active party participants, in that they would have or exert some control of the manner in which the state was proceeding on a trial. We submit that the state of Texas, the Texas Department of Human Resources, the Dallas County Child Welfare Unit is the authorized agent of the state to proceed in this kind of way. In order or for the interveners to be allowed to assert or interject whatever interest they would have or are asserting that they have acquired as a result of the child being in their home for 11 months, we do not think that the interest at that particular point in time was justiciable enough to allow them or grant them standing to intervene at that stage of the proceeding where the state of Texas was in fact attempting to terminate the parental rights They subsequently went to trial, did in fact terminate the natural mother. The court, they stipulated as to the culpability of the father. There was no culpability found on the father's part because of stipulations of the counsel. And the Brewers were allowed at that point, or Mrs. Brewer rather, was allowed to testify as to what she asserted to be the best interest of the child. And also informed the court at that point of the trial case on the merits that she in fact wanted to adopt the child. The court subsequently went ahead and allowed Mr. Mendez, the respondent below and petitioner before the court today, to be named the managing conservator of the child.
Counsel, would you elaborate just a little on the stipulation that Mr. Mendez had missed?
At page 8 of the transcript, the statement of facts, Your Honor, the court is asking the state of Texas whether they were prepared to proceed. The court, the state did say that they were prepared to proceed, but the state wished to stipulate as to the injuries. The stipulation, and I can quote that, is that the state would further stipulate that the injuries were not a result of physical abuse by the father.
Child abuse allegations were against the mother then?
Yes, sir. Yes, that's correct. The mother's affidavit was on file and she had already made some admissions to that effect. The stipulation, as I said, was as to the culpability of the father, and of course, counsel below amended the stipulation somewhat in that the word abuse was taken out of it, and the stipulation was that the abuse was, or the injury to the child was not caused by the conduct of the father, which the trial judge allowed the stipulation on the record and is a part of the record that is before the court today. We would submit to the court that then if you take the entire record as a whole and look at the situation that was before the bench or before the trial judge at that particular point, the record is replete with testimony and evidence as to the best interest of the child by the various professionals that were before the court as witnesses and those who had submitted the professional reports that were on file with the court at that time. And what happened basically was that the interveners at that point, the trial counsel was there. They were asked at the visitation hearing, for example, whether or not they wanted to call witnesses. They did not call any witnesses. They were given opportunities to cross-examine all the witnesses that were there before the court. And this was prior to the time, of course, that the court struck the intervention. As I said, the trial judge allowed them active participation up to and including the very day that he struck the intervention. We also admit that the confusion that would be caused in this particular proceeding was a valid point or sufficient cause to allow the trial court judge to strike the plea and intervention. We submit that the pivotal interest, the pivotal interest issue in this particular case was whether or not the state of Texas could prove the code grounds under 15.02.1e, which is they alleged that the natural parents had knowingly placed or allowed the child to be around persons to engage in conduct which would endanger the emotional and physical well-being of the child. And that was a pivotal issue. Of course, in addition to that, they could find that it was in the best interest of the child. But prior to reaching the question of best interest, the court is of necessity required to find the code grounds, the 1502E grounds. And the only interest or the only information that the Brewers, in fact, could have contributed was at the best interest. We submit that their participation as witnesses at the trial of the case on the merits was sufficient to allow any interest whatsoever that they were trying to assert coming before the court. The district court has wide discretion in determining what is in the best interest of the child in accordance with the constitutional mandate that is given to the district court in governing custody matters when it comes to the general interest and the general provisions of the Texas Family Code. The district court judge is the one who has that information before him, and he in fact is the one who can make those kinds of fact findings. And what we are submitting to the court today is that the Court of Civil Appeals was in effect substituting their methodology in determining best interest for that of the trial judge. We would submit that in matters of discretionary authority, when you have this kind of information before the court, that the Court of Civil Appeals is not in a posture to substitute its method of exercising this discretionary authority for that of the trial judge, when the judge is the one who has all the parties before him, and he in fact knows what has been going on in the case. This was a very active proceeding. virtually every month from the time that the case was filed in November of 1978 up to the time of the trial of the merits in March of 1980, there were just a series of motions, counter pleas, amended pleadings, general denials, special visitation hearings, and reviews of the status of the child in the foster care placement, as well as the status of the natural parents and their ability to care and provide adequate control, care, and provisions for the child in a home environment. We submit that since this is a case involving that the delay that would be caused by the allowance of the foster parent interveners to participate as active party participants is in fact relative or relevant, because you have a child that was almost in virtual limbo because of the fact that his natural parents were not able to care for him. And the placement with the foster parents was in fact a temporary substitute placement under the foster care program as outlined by the Texas Department of Human Resources, as regulated by the Texas Department of Human Resources.
Is anything in the record to show what the law requires of the foster parent, or any contract, anything like that?
Yes, there is. There is a contract with the foster parent, and at the deposition that was taken of the foster mother, and at the trial of the case in the merits, the regulations are available. They were available to the court. The contract between the foster placement and the Department of Human Resources was before the court. And it does stipulate in there that the court has the authority to remove the child at any time, and also that the Department of Human Resources has the authority to take the child from the foster placement at any time. There is no requirement of notice to the foster parents, and there is no requirement, of course, that they be given any kind of hearing as to whether or not the child should be removed from their home. Your Honor, we also submit to the court that the manner in which, or what we would like to do, of course, is to label the care of the foster parents that which exactly it was supposed and intended to do. This was a situation where the system actually worked. You had a temporary placement, and the system was intended to provide this kind of short-term temporary care for the child. The state, of course, could get the child back at any time. The foster parent could ask for the child to be removed. And what happens in these kinds of proceedings is that the natural parents are not aware of who the foster parents are. It is a policy of the Department of Human Resources to keep the identity of the foster parents anonymous. In this particular instance, because of the nature of the situation, the natural parents subsequently learned who the foster parents were as a result of their petition and intervention being filed. And in the other time, and in the other cases that are like this, of this nature, that are before the court, the foster parents are very rarely known to the natural parents, and it's a rarer situation where they file pleas and petitions and intervention, and much less be allowed to participate at the trial level so far as testimony and as witnesses. In this particular instance, we submit that the allowance of the foster parents to intervene at that stage of the proceeding would in fact be a breakdown of the system. The child has already been thrown into a state of virtual limbo. It would be a different situation, of course, if the state of Texas were not working with the parents, if the proceeding was not active, if there was no attempt at all to try and bring these parents up to the standards that the Department of Human Resources felt they had to meet in order to adequately provide support and care for the child. In this situation, it's not as if the natural parents are not being constantly requested to do certain things. The natural father, who is the petitioner before the court today, attended the parenting and training center. He attended psychological evaluation, psychological counseling. He went to classes on how to treat the medical problems of the child as a result of the injury inflicted by the mother. He did several other things that the court had required of him in order, and the Department of Human Resources, in fact, had required of him in order to demonstrate to them that he, in fact, was a person who could provide the adequate care, the kind of control of the environment that would be necessary to protect the child and the child's best interest. We would submit that With respect to the interest that was alleged in the petition under the Rule 60 intervention analysis, of course, that the interest was not sufficient to show a legal or an equitable interest that would be justiciable at that particular point in time. We also submit that the original petition in intervention on behalf of the foster parent intervenors had not met the prerequisites of the intervention rule of law. The only thing, of course, that they asserted was a contingent plan on wanting to adopt a child. And we submit that that plan could not, in fact, come into any a verifiable interest until the state, if in fact it was able to reach it, a final judgment and determination to prove their case. The mere possibility that the interveners might become the adoptive parents of the child, the subject of the suit, did not make that possibility an interest that would have allowed the trial judge to allow them to intervene at that point in time and the stage of the decedent. The other holdings of the Court of Civil Appeals as to point of error number 4, and under point of error number 2, we would submit that the trial judge did not in fact abuse his discretion. That because of the information that he had before him at that stage of the proceedings, from October of 1979 up until January of 1980, when the intervention was struck, that there was sufficient information for the judge to exercise his discretion and strike the plea in intervention. We submit that the allowance of the foster parent to intervene at that stage of the proceeding to compete with the fundamental rights of the natural parents with respect to the familial ties and the biological relationship with the child would be, in effect, derogating the rights of the natural parents to an inferior position in the court. And the trial judge recognized that, in addition to the fact that all the information that they sought to bring before the court was, in fact, before the court. We would also submit that probably one of the more profound and far-reaching implications of the Court of Civil Appeals' opinion is that the court found, or rather the holding, that the foster parents had the standing to intervene under the Texas Family Code, Section 11.03. And what we are talking about here basically is an attempt at finding a statutory definition for what any person with an interest is supposed to mean. We submit that the general provisions of Chapter 11 must be construed with the specific provisions of Chapter 15, that the information that was available as to any person with an interest that has been, from our research and analyzation of the case law that we have been able to find on that, we submit that the construction of that particular statute does not have within its contemplation foster parents. We submit that the statutes, and it's doubtful that under the analyzation of Chapter 15 that the foster parents will qualify as any person with an interest under that particular statute or at that particular point in stage of the proceedings. We, of course, are not submitting that the foster parents are forever foreclosed from seeking to obtain the custody of children that are placed in their care. It would be a situation where if
well,
a child...
the contract speaks to that. In any way, contract between the state and the foster parent.
There is indication in the contract, Your Honor, that the foster parents, from our understanding of the relationship that is developed between the Department of Human Resources and foster care placement, that they are made aware that the time the child is placed in their home, that they are not supposed to intervene or try and attempt to adopt the child until after there is some decision as to where the natural parents stand, as to whether or not the right should be terminated or whether or not the natural parent should be, or the child should be returned to the custody of the natural parent. As you said, Your Honor, we are not submitting that the foster parents are foreclosed forever from developing some kind of an interest. And naturally, of course, there's going to have to be some arbitrariness as to a time span. If a child is in a state of virtual limbo for 2 or 3 years, 4 or 5 years down the road, and the state does not attempt in any active way to proceed to either return the child to its home or terminate the parental rights, then of course a child who has probably been in all of its conscious life in the possession of foster parents, it would be natural for them to develop some attachment, some ties, and develop an interest that would in fact probably at that stage, were it 2 or 3 or 4 years down the road and the child had been there for all that time, that would be equitable interest or a legal interest for that matter, under 11.03, because they would in fact probably become any person with an interest at that stage. But we submit that at the point at which they filed the petition and intervention, they were not in fact any persons with an interest under the Texas Family Code, nor were they persons with an interest that was sufficient enough to interject their interest into the case, nor would the judgment, whether it be for or against the natural parents, have adversely affected any intent that they had. So far as the laws of equity are concerned, they in fact exercised the other remedy that was available to them in that they filed the subsequent proceeding and attempted to consolidate that proceeding with trial case on the merits. We ask that the court affirm the judgment of the trial court judge. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The argument from Ms. Thomas.
I plead the court. Mr. R. Lewis Nicholson will present argument for responding.
May it please the court. Briefly, I would like to go through a little procedural problem that we have here. The original case involved four parties, the Department of Human Resources, as well as the Mendezes and the Brewers, and the child, who was represented by a guardian ad litem. At this proceeding today, we only have two of the four parties present. Also, there were two lawsuits involving these same issues, which were appealed to the Court of Civil Appeals, and I believe both of those matters are before the court today. The original termination filed by the Department of Human Resources, where the Brewers attempted to intervene, was actually tried and appealed and is the primary case that discussion has been held where the intervention occurred. When the intervention was denied, a separate suit was filed by the Brewers, bringing in all of the parties, alleging a combined termination and adoption action, which Chapter 16 of the Family Code authorizes a combination, and a consolidation was sought with the Department of Human Resources case. The petitioner before you today argued at the intervention hearing that the intervenors had no cause of action, had no standing, and should be denied their right to intervene and should be required to bring an independent suit. When they did bring an independent suit alleging full status, the Mendezes at that point argued that the matter had already been heard at the intervention, and at the hearing on consolidation, in effect, a summary judgment was entered denying them the right to proceed, that the matter had been taken care of at the hearing on intervention. The end result was Brewers had no hearing on the merits of their cause of action in either case. The Court of Civil...
Their cause of action served in the first suit was one for adoption, was it not?
In the original suit brought by Department of Human Resources, and I was not involved at that stage, I do not think pleadings were properly presented. I think they could have been repled, but the allegations of the intervenors were that they wanted the same result that the state wanted. However, after that, they wanted to adopt. I think they would have been better in the intervention to have actually sought the adoption, but the literal reading of their pleading was that they wanted to adopt after the termination.
Then that was a pure termination case.
That one, as I understand it, was a pure termination case.
And that was the case in which the judge said, you're not yet interested, or I'm going to exercise my discretion at this point in time and not let you get into the termination case.
That is correct, and that may have been an appropriate decision at that time. But today, I feel we have to consider both actions, and the second suit filed by the Brewers was a combined termination and adoption case.
Are those papers before this court?
They should be.
Are they? The adoption is a separate proceeding, as I understand it.
The second action involving this child, Mendez's child, was a combined termination and adoption filed by the Brewers.
Are those papers before this court?
Yes, sir. Both of those causes were appealed to the Court of Civil Appeals. The Court of Civil Appeals rendered an opinion on the intervention case, the pure termination case, and as an aside,
my problem is, we look at the validity of the trial court's judgment, it would seem, at the time and in the posture of the case, at the time he made his decision. What I think I'm hearing you say is that even though the decision may have been right at one time, there were some more papers filed over here, and the judge therefore should have withdrawn that decision.
I'm saying that both of those actions are before you today, and the respondent takes the position that the Brewers were entitled to a hearing on the merit in one action or the other, and the trial court erred in the intervention, or the trial court erred in denying the consolidation. The end result is that the error occurred prior to the trial of the first suit, and both of those actions are before the court today. And whether the Court of Civil Appeals entered their judgment in the wrong cause that came to the right conclusion would be the position I'm taking today. And I believe that the primary issue before the court, setting aside the procedural problem, is the standing of a foster parent or of any other person to become involved in a termination suit.
Do you allege anything different in the termination suit, the grounds for termination that the state hadn't alleged in the first suit?
No, sir. I believe both the Department of Human Resources and the Brewers alleged the same grounds for
termination. The Court of Civil Appeals, in setting up a test for abuse of discretion, said that you had an absolute right to intervene if it was essential to effectively protect the intervener's interest or the interest of the child. Now, the intervener's interest wouldn't arise until the child is terminated, would it?
Under the right of a combined termination and adoption case.
Well, they don't have a right to adopt until it's terminated, do they? Can you adopt a child that hadn't been terminated?
No, sir. Under Chapter 16, yes.
Well, did you try it here, under Chapter 6 or any other chapter, or were you coming in as a terminated, to adopt a terminated child?
The 1603 says that no petition for adoption may be considered unless a termination has occurred or unless the termination proceeding is joined with.
My question was that the only right foster parents asserted was the right to adopt the child after being terminated, wasn't it?
In the first action, that is correct. In the second action, they just outright alleged they had the right to adopt the child.
A right to adopt the child. And who made that up?
I
have two adopted grandsons, but I had to figure out I had to go right to go get them.
Well, they had the right to bring the action, I believe, and the right to put on evidence as the allegations of the propriety of the adoption, I think would be a better way of expressing that.
What hearing are we talking about now?
I'm talking about the second hearing, the combined termination and adoption case.
Well, we have in this instance a father from whom there has, about whom there has been a decision that there will not be a termination as to him.
Yes, sir.
All right. Then adoption can't even arise until somehow or other we get that father out of the picture. So it really gets back, does it not, to the right of the foster parents to come in as a party to the suit, to get that father out of the picture in some way. Because you don't start hearing evidence about adoption until that father is out of the way.
I agree with you completely.
I would not say the foster parents have been able to accomplish what they wanted to accomplish by being witnesses in the state's termination case that the people were unfit. Why do they have to intervene?
I believe that the participation in trial as a litigant as opposed to participation as a witness is very different. I understand that Mrs. Brewer was called and did testify at the trial of this cause. She did not have the right at the trial to cross-examine any witnesses.
Is there any evidence that the Department of Welfare would not have permitted your people to give all the testimony they had about child abuse, drug abuse, and...
I have no way of knowing the answer to that, Judge. And I believe in that instance, the primary evidence that the Brewers could have offered would be as to best interest of the child.
First, you got to get termination before you get the best interest, as far as I'm concerned. Somebody may have been able to raise my natural son better than I did. You were not rich, or you had a lot of problems, you know, financial, not a lot, some. The people across town could have done a whole lot better jobs, send them on trips, you know, all this stuff. But for the best interest of the child, maybe they ought to move over to the self-parking area. Now, do you take on judge where the child is the best interest of my house or somebody else's house? You have a trial on that before you find me unfit?
As I understand, to terminate, there has to be a combination of some act or omission on the part of the parent.
You got to terminate me before you got a right to judge whether I'm raising a child better or somebody else.
Yes, sir.
I think.
But our contention is that we have the right to make the allegation that, for instance, you have been guilty of an act or omission and to have a trial on that issue.
What is the basis for that? As a foster parent having the right to come in on termination?
I believe a foster parent should have as much right, if not more right, than any other person to become involved in a termination.
And why do you say that?
All right, because Chapter 18, which was added to the Family Code in 1979, expands, and we have not gotten to this point, but the Pratt case out of Amarillo.
And the Pratt case was not a foster parent. That was a former foster parent from whom the children had been removed because of getting divorced.
Well, I understand, but the Pratt case limited participation to people who were listed in Section 11.09A.
Entitled service.
That's correct.
Okay.
The court did not look at 1109B, which says any other person who has or may allege an interest in the child. And Section 1802C adds, in addition to those persons listed in Section 1109A of this code as entitled to service in a suit affecting the parent-child relationship, a person listed in 1803 of this code is entitled to service of citation. 1803, subsection 2, lists a foster parent as being entitled to service, entitled to 10 days' notice, and they're entitled to present evidence and be heard at the hearing. Chapter 18 comes into play at any time that the
department... termination hearing?
No.
Your interpretation of 1803 says they're entitled to notice and a termination hearing?
No. I'm saying that 1803 gives them entitlement to notice under 1109. And the Pratt case holds if you're entitled to notice under 1109, you're entitled to participate. 1109 on its face does not even list the Department of Human Resources as being entitled to notice And a strict reading of the Pratt case could prevent even the Department of Human Resources from participating in a termination fee, which I think would be a miscarriage of justice to limit termination to only people listed in 1109. And the status of a foster parent is given a greater standing than unrelated outsiders under Chapter 18. Chapter 16 has a prerequisite of the child in the home for 6 months before adoption. This can be waived, but I believe that one acquires an interest in a child once that child has been in the home 6 months. Chapter 18 comes into play when Human Resources has had a child for 6 months. There must be a review at least every 6 months in connection with children in their care and control. And foster parents at that point have acquired an interest which is recognized under the code. And
recognized under the code, and what's the contract between the people? Do you, at 6 months, do you acquire some interest? I just don't see how you could get an interest in somebody else. But it isn't the contract between the state and the foster parent one of custodial care, no more, no less?
I believe there is a line of authority, whether it's within Texas or out, saying that contracts denying you the right to seek adoption of a child are contrary to public policy.
You don't need to say you can't adopt, but does it give you an interest in the child?
No, sir. But my feeling, anytime a child is in a home, a single home, for at least 6 months, those people have acquired at least the right to be heard. I am not saying those people have taken adverse possession. That's not what I mean to say.
You would restore the right to custodial care, it seems to me, if after 6 months, some children are not adoptable, as I understand. So they
correct.
Must be cared for. Cannot the state provide just for custody?
I'm saying after 6 months, the state cannot take the children out and without giving the foster parent an opportunity to be heard of whether that's
the best
interest.
I thought the contract said otherwise, as I heard counsel.
I heard counsel say that also, Judge. I have not seen a copy of the contract. I do not believe the contract is in the record before the court, which puts us at a disadvantage.
It might not be for the best interest of the child to become attached to the foster parent. Works both ways.
Oh, granted. This child, at the time of trial, had been in the home of the foster
parent. Not your foster parent, anyway. No.
At the time of the trial, this child had been in the Brewer's home for 17 months, had only been in the parent's home for 14 months. If you look at time
and
alone...
That's relevant on the issue of adoption only, isn't it? Would that be relevant on termination of father?
So the court chose to not terminate and return the child. There were serious allegations and evidence presented that the father was a passive abuser. The stipulation that was entered as to the father only was that he did not participate in the active abuse.
As I understand, what your position has to be is, it's not that you have a right that the statute gives you to try a termination and adoption proceeding together. Statute says you can't.
Yes, sir.
But to uphold the opinion in this case, you have to say you must do it, would you not? That the trial court has used its discretion in separating the two.
Well, the trial court denied the Brewers a hearing in the second suit, summarily.
Well,
from what you're saying, the court might not abuse its discretion in not consolidating the DHR with the Brewer suit. And perhaps that argument could be made, but the trial court erred in not giving them a hearing at all, in my opinion. And it would make better sense to me to have a single trial than to have a trial with DHR as petitioner and a trial with Brewer.
The issue is whether the parent should be terminated and whether someone else would be proper to adopt a child are completely different issues. I mean, I think it would clutter up the case rather than simplify it.
Well, the Kalutis case out of Houston felt that the trial court could protect all of the parties and that the better practice would be to have a single trial. And we have...
The Kalutis decision said it was up to the trial court's discretion as to whether or not to admit an intervention or deny an intervention. In that case, the trial court admitted the intervention, and the Court of Appeals held that was not an abuse of discretion. So getting back to the discretion on the part of the trial judge in an intervention.
All right, I understand what you're saying. And again, I still feel the Brewers had the right to a hearing in one cause or the other of their action. And while the trial court might have been correct at the time it denied the intervention, or might have acted within its discretion based with what was before it at that time, I feel the trial court was incorrect then in the second action, which is also before the court.
Even though these two may be consolidated, I'm having difficulty seeing how you reach the adoption issue until you have successfully crossed the termination issue. And what the court has said, the trial court said, in the exercise of my judgment and discretion, I'm not going to permit you to be a party to the termination. And it occurs to me that the Court of Civil Appeals has said that as a matter of law, any foster parent is entitled to intervene in any termination proceeding. Now, is that an overstatement?
I believe it could be read that way. And that is the reason in my argument I'm taking the position that there should be a six-month limitation rather than any foster parent. If the child is placed today, tomorrow, I don't think they should be entitled to run down and file an action or to intervene in an action. I do feel if the child has been in a foster home for 6 months, at that point the foster parent should be permitted to intervene and participate. I do not think we have before us a findings of fact and conclusions of law from the trial court to know the basis of the appointment of the father as managing conservator. We don't know if he found the father was guilty of passive abuse, but it was still in the best interest to return the child, or whether he did not participate in any act that would justify terminating his rights. There are no findings of facts and conclusions, and since the termination is a two-pronged requirement, we don't know which prong the father prevailed on. And in a retrial, we could very well have a different result. I would like the court, on the issue of standing, which is still my contention that the Brewers had standing to be heard, to compare the family code with the probate code, where in connection with a minor, any person has the right to appear and be heard. In a decedent's estate, you must have standing, you must have an interest to participate in anything involving the estate of the decedent. Likewise, under the family code, to get involved in a divorce, I think you're going to have standing to get involved in a divorce action. But in connection with the custody or support, access, termination, anything to do with the child, the whole world really has standing. And
That's what the court of appeals says. And I really doubt it, but there's no legal stranger in the law. Boy, that's pretty broad.
It's extremely broad.
Anybody intermeddle anywhere, anytime. No legal stranger.
I believe that has been the law in Texas for many years, and the ultimate test involving children has always been the best interest of the child. And I believe that test should continue. That requirement is brought to us in chapters 14, 15, 16, 18 at all points. The best interest of the child is the ultimate test.
Counsel, is it your intention that the well-meaning old maid three blocks over has a right to go down and petition for termination of parental rights anytime she sees a child around the neighborhood is not being raised like she thinks it ought to be?
Carrying things to an extreme, yes, sir. I think that is preferable.
Not carrying it to extreme. At any time, what you said was you can't.
I believe you can bring the action. Obviously, you're not going to prevail in the action. I think any time two cars collide, one party can sue the other, or both can sue each other. I don't think you can limit access to the court.
What you're contending, though, is that would be subject to a plea and abatement or no standing. You've got to go down and have a full-blown hearing just because this kind old lady wants all the kids raised the way she thinks they ought to be raised, not having raised one at home. She's an expert, of course.
They ought not to be bused across town. They ought to be sent to a private school. That's the way I live. What the old lady would say.
I understand the problem the court is facing, but if the court limits who has access to the court.
Well, why not leave it in the discretion of the trial court? So you haven't got any right in this case.
I think the court could find that you have no grounds. I don't think it's appropriate to say you have no right to bring the action. On the merits, I believe the court can and will protect the parent and the child in the situation of the old maid down the street.
Isn't child abuse and child neglect a pretty good place to start? If you can prove neglect or abuse, can you get things? Not just wisdom and how you raise.
Yes, sir, but until you can allege abuse, whether you can prove it is another matter entirely.
The interest of the child might not involve either.
If you can make an allegation, and how one knows whether the allegation is good faith or not, is a question in every lawsuit, whether the allegations are made in good faith. Everyone will tell you that their allegations are made in good faith. And if the court is going to start looking at allegations and deciding if they're made in good faith, I feel the only way to get to that is on the merits, not on the standing. Thank you.
Of course, take a brief recess.
Right.
I'm Brenda Garrett from Dallas, Texas. In this particular cause of action on appeal, the fact remains that the sole issue before the Court of Civil Appeals was whether or not the trial judge had abused his discretion in denying an intervention and also refusing to consolidate the two trials. Counsel has acknowledged that there was sufficient information before the trial judge during the intervention to perhaps allow him to exercise his discretion in favor of striking the intervention. His argument is that at this stage that the Brewers have a right to be heard on their consolidation. There was a hearing for the consolidation, which was scheduled for February 4, 1980. At that time, on a motion in plea and bar, or alternatively plea and abatement, which was filed by the petitioner here, Mr. Mendez, the judge abated the Brewers' consolidation suit. Counsel's asking that, and the Court of Civil Appeals' opinion, by virtue of its remand of this case to the trial court, is asking at this late date, 2 years down the road, when this child has been with his, back with his father, to send this case back to the trial court, have the trial court retry it for the purpose of allowing the Brewers to come in and give testimony on best interest as party litigants rather than as witnesses of the, at the trial. This child has not stopped growing during that time period. If the state could not prove up the code ground under the preponderance of evidence standard that was in effect in 1980 when this case was tried, they cannot prove them up in 1981 under the clear and convincing standard that has been announced by this court. The record on this case is clear, including the deposition of Ms. Susan Brewer herself, that they had nothing, absolutely nothing, to contribute to Code Grant, that they knew nothing about this situation, other than that they felt that it would be in the best interest of the child to be with them. And what they wanted to put before the trial court was the fact that their home was available for placement. That issue was before the trial court. Nothing can be accomplished by sending this call back to the trial court and having the case retried when best interest alone is simply not sufficient to terminate parental rights. Additionally, counsel argues that the foster parents ought to have a right to intervene in the termination suit if they've had a foster child in their care for 6 months. Even under the Smith versus Arthur case, the U.S. Supreme Court has indicated that 18 months is a constitutionally adequate period in terms of trying to decide if there is an interest in the foster parent. This interest that the foster parent is alleging is based upon a psychological bonding or attachment to the child. That psychological bonding does not take place overnight. If it happens at all, it takes place over a period of time. If we talk about 6 months as a sufficient period of time, that is not taking into consideration the reality of the foster care system here. At a very minimal, when you're talking about a voluntary placement, you're talking about 2 months. In this particular case, when the case first began in November of 1978, there were two children involved. The second child, Manuel Jr., was returned to the parents 10 months later. There was no harm to that child at all. There was no injury to that particular child. That child was removed 3 days from the time of his birth, but it took approximately 10 months just to move the child back to the father. And the reason it took that long was that what was happening during that time period was that Mr. Mendez was engaged in counseling, he was engaged in parenting skills classes, he was asked to find a job, he was asked to find housing. And that is the situation, the practicality of that system. Once a child is in the system with the Department of Human Resources, certainly they're not going to want to return the child home until such time as the parent can show that they can adequately provide for the child by having a home, by having a job, by having counseling if that is necessary. And that takes time. In case of if the parent is eligible for public housing, there is at least a 6 month, as much as a 6 month waiting list So we're saying that 6 months is certainly not a sufficient time to even allow the system to work. In the case before this court, the system was working. It was moving forward. This child was going to be sent home. The foster parents on the record indicate that they knew from the beginning that this was a temporary placement, that the Department of Public Welfare could pull the child out of their home at any time without notice to them. That contract is in the record, in the deposition of Ms. Susan Brewer. That is before this court. The Brewers in this case were, in fact, paid caretakers by the state. They were receiving $157 a month to look after this child. They did not pay any of the child's medical expenses during that entire time period. They did not pay for any of the child's clothing. All of that was taken care of by the state. And the only reason, the only relationship or interest that they had was by virtue of that contract with the state. And the effect of the Court of Civil Appeals opinion as it presently stands is to completely frustrate that system. If we argue that foster parents have standing on 11.03, is that to say that after a month or 2 months, the state can intervene in this proceeding? So therefore, there has to be a time period involved. Counsel talks about 11.09B, where the legislature indicated that citation may be given. The use of may in 11.09B certainly indicates some discretion on the part of the judge, as opposed to the use of entitled to in 11.09A. And certainly 11.09A is intended to cover as many sections of the code as possible. It talks about Chapter 13, the penalty fees. It talks about managing the servitors, persons with a court-ordered relationship to the child. It talks about Chapter 15 as well. So certainly there has to be some discretion in determining whether or not it is in the best interest. And that discretion is given to the trial judge. And the test is still whether or not the trial judge has acted arbitrarily and unreasonably. And in this particular case, there is no evidence on this record that under the circumstances present at that time that the trial judge acted arbitrarily or unreasonably. There is no evidence that any actions of the trial judge has prejudiced the rights of the Brewers in any way, form, or fashion. They were able to give input into this trial with their testimony. They were able, they are still able at this day, if they wish to do so, to file a termination suit by virtue of the fact that the suit was finally dismissed after the trial on the merits, but it was dismissed without prejudice. So the judge did not in any way prejudice any rights that the Brewers might have by virtue of his numbers. One, blocking the intervention, and secondly, refusing to consolidate their independent cause of action with the primary case of the state.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted on written briefs and oral arguments for both parties. That concludes the oral submissions today, and the marshal is adjourned.